Welcome back. I'm so excited to share this interview with you with my friend Amy Liz Harrison. She is a super mom and it is no joke. She's a mother of 8 children, best-selling author, sobriety coach, and recovery mental health advocate with over a decade of sobriety under her belt. I had the pleasure of meeting her in person finally in Los Angeles recently. We've been sober curating, working for the blog for several years together. She made a choice to leave her position as a 10th grade English teacher to focus on raising her 8 children, as you can imagine. Having found sobriety in 2011, she keeps it raw and real in this conversation, and I really think you're going to learn a lot. She also believes if you don't tell her that she has lettuce in her teeth, you are dead to her. Fair enough. She is the founder and CEO of indie publishing company A-Team Press, where she republished her memoirs, one of which is entitled Eternally Expecting, A Mom of 8 Gets Sober and Gives Birth to a Whole New Life. She has several books. One of her more recent publications, she's diving into the realm of children's fiction. Mommy Goes to Meetings is now available on Amazon, and I highly recommend you check it out if you or someone in your life has a parent going through getting sober. It's great to have these tools for the kids. And Amy has her own podcast called Eternally Amy, a sober mom of 8's journey from jail to joy. I had the honor of being on it, I believe it was last year, so I might drop that link down here too. So let's dive in. Welcome to season 5 of the Wellness as a Way of Life podcast, the less is more source of wellness, knowledge, wisdom, and inspiration for female leaders and founders. Here, we teach you why not all wellness trends are for you, how to figure out which ones are, and how to best adapt them for your own personal wellness toolbox. Ultimately, we need to know how to integrate your wellness practices so fully that they become to feel like brushing your teeth, a foundational part of who you are and not a checkmark on your to-do list. I'm your host, Megan Swan, creator of the Wellness as a Way of Life community and the Sustainable Integrated Wellness Approach. I have more than a decade of experience in the wellness industry and on my own personal journey. Learning how to tune into and trust my intuition and drown out all the noise. As a certified health coach, detoxification expert, plant-based chef, yoga teacher, and consultant, I will help you distill down the information overload and feel more confident and at ease in your own skin. Welcome back to Wellness as a Way of Life. I'm so honored to have Amy Liz Harrison with us today. She is a multi-published author. She is an expert on motherhood for sure and all things mental health and alcoholism. Where should we start, Amy? How are you? Let's start there.
I'm so good, but I'm pretty much happiest at this very moment to be here. So thanks for having me on, Megan. And I got sober in 2011, and it's been a journey ever since then. And it's been, I think, kind of almost like watching a little kid learn to walk, watching, you know, a little bit of a stumble here and there. But I found my way. And what I love about this recovery journey in general is that we can all kind of go about it in our own different manners, and it all works. It all counts, you know? And so I love that so much about sobriety. So if you want me to kind of give like a brief overview of my story, I'm happy to do that, or kind of what my life is like now, either way.
Yeah, no, like paint the picture a little, you know.
Yeah.
With some major catalysts, and give the audience a bit more depth of, you know, how much you really know what you're talking about here.
Well, I'll qualify myself as an alcoholic. I call myself an alcoholic. I know people have different terms they like to use this day. Here for it, support it, and love it. but I basically was born and raised into a very happy, for all intents and purposes, non-alcoholic home. And I never even really drank before I turned 21. I had a lot of internal feelings of feeling different than other people and feeling like I had a little bit less insulation than some folks, mm-hmm. and really spent the majority of my teen and youth years looking for validation, feeling very empty, looking for something to fill the hole in my soul. And at that time, what that was for me was church and church groups. And so while I'm all about it, and I think that's great, and definitely was a huge part of my life at one point in time, now I see myself as more of a spiritual being rather than a religious person. Mm-hmm. But that all came in time, right? That was part of the unfolding of me figuring out who I was as a person and as a woman and as a mother. And so what happened for me was, you know, I had all these really big questions. I had a lot of big needs in terms of feeling very needy, feeling very much like nothing could really satiate my soul. And I really, looking back on it now, and I'm fine with how my journey had to unfold to get me to where I am today, but it does make me a little bit sad that I never realized, you know, it's like Oprah Winfrey always says, you know, she talks about the Wizard of Oz and you always had it, my dear. I really didn't realize that it was inside of me, that what I was looking for in terms of fulfillment and validation was inside of me. And that once I cultivated that relationship with myself, that that would all come and that I would feel, you know, comfortable with my own self and my own skin and enjoy my own company. So I got married, we moved to Seattle, I started to have some babies. And I felt so lonely, and just really felt like I couldn't be real with anybody about the depth of that loneliness. Mm-hmm. I also do believe I had some postpartum depression sprinkled in there, which later I was diagnosed with adult ADHD. And my psychiatrist had said, you know, I'd love for you to get tested for this. And I just kind of was like, I don't have it. But he was right. Shocker. And so one of the symptoms of this soul sickness was drinking. And I found that escape. First, it started really slowly in book clubs. You know, I was meeting people and getting away from the little kid thing at night. And being able to once a month kind of feel like a whole person again. Motherhood was a real struggle for me at the beginning. I really felt like I had lost my identity of who I was. You know, I used to teach 10th grade English, and now here I am at home wiping butts and cleaning up messes all the time. And so it was an escape.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I think that's such a common experience. And we're just not allowed to talk about it.
Right. Exactly. And that's part of the misnomer that I had, was like, oh, well, I'm supposed to be totally fulfilled by this. You know, mm-hmm. this is that one thing that women, you know, are supposed to just, oh, change my entire world. Well, it did change my entire world, but it dumped me on my head and shook everything out of me, you know, and I just couldn't really figure out who I was now. And so I think as my drinking progressed, so what happened was I started hanging out in the cul-de-sac with other moms in the afternoons, and we would have these mommy wine club type activities. Kids would all be riding bikes and we would sit there and talk and bond and drink. And so after some time, as the progression of alcoholism does, I found myself like wanting it more and more, and like having a glass of wine at nap time, and then having a glass of wine or two or three before I'd go out and meet with those ladies in the afternoon. And so I really didn't admit to my innermost self that it had a hold of me. I thought I was still controlling my drinking. And I thought it made me glamorous. You know, I felt very connected to these ladies. And what I didn't realize at the time was it was a false connection. You know, I was able to kind of put on this facade like everything was fine when I was drinking until it was out of control. And it was very clear that, you know, I was the one kind of stumbling around and overly served in the afternoons. And so that progression happened over about, I'd say about a 3-year period-ish. And then because it started getting so bad and I couldn't be relied upon to be sober enough to like take my kids to swim practice in the afternoon or whatever, you know, it started becoming like a problem for me, right? And so my psychiatrist said, well, I think, you know, you really should maybe take a look at your drinking. No, I wasn't going to do that. So I told him, which I did have alcoholic panic attacks at the time, but I wasn't linking everything together because I wasn't being honest with him about my consumption. So I got to the point where I was taking Xanax, and that was really my downfall. I landed in treatment, really was not happy to be there. I was sent there by my husband, and I really didn't own it for my own self, right? Like for me, I was just there to get everybody kind of off my back. My thought pattern was that I would learn to control my drinking and go back and everything would be fine. And so I did go back home, met with those same old ladies in the cul-de-sac and lied and said, oh, they taught me how to drink normally in treatment. Yeah, they don't do that in treatment.
They bought it?
What? And so 2 weeks later, I found myself arrested for a DUI. I had my 4 little kids in the car, was pulled over right after school, broad daylight. All these people saw me who I knew. And boom, I was in King County Jail for the night. And really, that was the beginning of me admitting, yeah, there's something really broken here. And I'm going to start with this. I'm going to start by saying I am an alcoholic and I don't know that I will be able to get sober, but I need to try. And so I went back to treatment with some willingness. And that was, I would say, my rock bottom, if you know, you want to use that phrase. It was the beginning of a whole new life for me. And, you know, I realized that it's not about failing or succeeding, but that really what I had to do was change my whole definition of what success was. And I still work on that part of it today. But really, that was the beginning of the journey of me realizing, okay, I'm not going to hide behind this anymore. I'm not going to hide the fact that I feel so internally raw. I'm going to just come out with all of this, and that I don't know who I am, and I don't know who God is, or if there is a God. And I mean, I let it all out because I thought, it seems like that is what you really have to do, is let it all, you know, go in order to rebuild. And so it's been a process, that is for sure. But oh my gosh, what a great, I mean, sometimes I think about like, gosh, what if I never got sober? What if I was out there still drinking? Or if I just had never had anything happen in my life where everything collapsed and I was willing to do the work and really, you know, sort through my past and get to the roots of why these behaviors of wanting to escape existed. And it makes me kind of sad for that person who might have been, and so glad that I have tools now, you know. And like, my life is not perfect, far from it. But I feel like in some ways you know, gosh, I wonder if somebody had told me early on, you know, if you give up this alcohol, this security blanket, this thing that you think is working for you, and you see what's on the other side of it, you would be amazed. I wonder if I would have gotten there any quicker, but I didn't. It took what it took, and that was all right. And it was all right primarily because later on, as I began to do the inner work, I was like, wait a second, this is actually like the best thing that has ever happened to me, you know, but I needed that unpacking and reframing to occur.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, neither of us had role models like us back then, right? Like
I
couldn't even think of one semi famous, or, I mean, it was just a completely different world. But I don't spend a lot of time, but I have also thought those thoughts of, you know, if I had just been laid out for me as like a real option, or just understanding how it's, you know, either worsening whatever existing mental health issues are going on, or potentially even creating them. So I'd love to, I mean, you said so much, and I just love how, you know, forthcoming and transparent you are in your story. I think it's so powerful. And, you know, there's so many things that you said that I think many, many women, mothers or not, can relate to, in terms of, you know, just not feeling like you quite belong, or there's just like something. And, you know, we're sold this narrative that alcohol connects us. You know, you have deep conversations and deep girly interactions, and yet where are they when you don't want to drink anymore, right? Same girlfriends.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. So, and I had that experience.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure we could talk a lot about that, but I'd love to know more about your sort of insight now, looking back, because I'm guessing now you have been tested for ADHD, and like, looking back, can you see more now how the alcohol was just, you know, adding fire, or just maybe not allowing you to see things any differently?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And thank you for that question. It's so important, right? To look back and try and like put those pieces together and really just kind of go, oh, yes, that's exactly what it was. And, you know, for me, I grew up in the Silicon Valley, and I was around a lot of really smart kids who had parents who were just at the very beginning of the high-tech boom. And, you know, I'm Generation X. So it was like during that time period, you know, and Steve Jobs was just starting Apple and all this stuff, you know, in Cupertino. And, you know, I felt dumb. I really felt stupid because I didn't learn as quickly or in the same way as a lot of my classmates. And so that continued into my teen years. It continued all the way through college, about like, man, I'm not quite getting it with the same speed as everybody else, or in the same teaching modalities as everybody else was able to understand the concepts that were being presented. And I never understood that, you know, maybe there was a certain way that I learned that was different. And I think that that's a key right there, is that, yeah, okay, I was a little different, and that was all right. And I think that at that time period, anyway, it was just hard to be faced with that word different, because it was not really celebrated, right? In the same way.
I was gonna say, like, now I think you could even describe it as a gift, right? Like, there's so much awareness around neurodivergence as just being like a different zone of genius, or a different way of looking at the world, not different in a bad way, just like adding another lens to our world.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And because I felt, you know, insecure and dumb and you know, like overly sensitive and all of this stuff. And I had rejection sensitivity. And then once I found alcohol, it was like, oh my gosh, like I can breathe. That's how it felt initially. Mm-hmm. And then later when my life spiraled out of control, right? That was when I was really like, now even this isn't working. And that's when I really felt screwed. Like, I don't know what I'm going to do now because none of this stuff is like, how do I operate in life? And I felt guilty because now, you know, I had kids and, you know, I'm this mother who can't get her shit together. And I just really felt that powerful, like, I think it might be a mistake that I'm here, you know, and I went through all the suicidal ideations and I apologize. I probably should have set a trigger warning before I said that. So you can put that on if you want. And, but I did, I had all of that angst of like, I actually hate myself kind of thing. But now looking back, once I realized that taking all of that work and time and tears that once I got sober to really examine my life and the roots of why is it that I felt dumb? Well, I didn't know anything about ADHD. Well, I didn't really know anything about the world of spirituality versus religion because, you know, you're brought up with one way and generally frowned upon if there are other pathways that might be different to some of those really strong religious ways of life. And so, you know, just all of these things. So the one thing I do want to say for sure, I'm like trying, I do not think of myself as a victim of anything. I really believe that it is empowering for us as women to examine our pasts and to really sort through sort of those junk drawers of things that we just put away and we don't deal with, but we actually do deal with because, you know, they're sort of festering there and we know that there's stuff shoved in that junk drawer that we don't want anybody to see, right? And now that we're in 2024 and we live in this Instagram world and it's curated and for sure we have shifted, right? We have turned the dial on being vulnerable and being like, oh, everything is not as it seems in the social media world.
It's not okay. Yeah.
Right. That it's great. And that is wonderful. But I feel also super strongly that, you know, we as women, I mean, we got to be able to say, yeah, I mean, come over. My house is a friggin' mess. Come over anyway. Doesn't matter. Because what matters is my connection with you and the bridges that we are going to build together through conversation and through being open. And I didn't know how to do that before. I really did not know how to do that. And I still struggle with it. Sometimes I'm like, oh my gosh, like just last night we had friends over and they're like really gourmet cooks. I'm not. And so I had that angst rise up again, like, oh, dang, you know, they're going to be like, why'd we have to go to her house? And these are people who know and love me. But, you know, it's still just part of, you know, being a human being and just feeling sort of like, oh, that's kind of uncomfortable sometimes. And when I say it, it takes the power out of it. And then I feel better. So that's been the biggest part for me is really using that piece of, for me, it was 12-step meetings and CBT but whatever it is that, you know, people find that helps them process, like all day long, I'm here for that. Because,
well, I'd love if we could just drill down a little bit more because a lot of women that listen to this podcast would probably not put themselves in a category of having a quote unquote problem. Right. And I think had I had the insight, the information earlier of just how directly my, you know, ongoing increasing lack of self-confidence and, you know, low level depression was just this loop of drinking. I was very high functioning. But I just probably would have decided to look at it earlier. Because I don't think I appreciated like how direct that relationship was until I was free from it. And it just got better and better and better as like the layers of months and years came off, just realizing how much, you become. Yeah. I mean, connected, you rely on just the buzz and the physical buzz. But then I think all the things that we've been talking about, you know, like that group of girlfriends or, you know, the book club, or like you associate all of this as being like the thing that is, you know, making you feel better, or that self-care, or that's for you as a mom who has very little time to herself probably. And just how powerful those stories we tell ourselves become, that it's really hard to kind of, until you're out of it, to see like what was going on.
Yeah. Yep. And I think that's so key. I mean, looking back on all of it now, I mean, you know, the pain that I felt when I looked in the mirror was really telling. And I really did not, for me, I'm not one of those people who like woke up in the morning and was like, oh, I'm not going to drink today. It got to the point toward the end of my drinking where I just thought, I'm not going to tell myself that I'm not going to drink today because I know that I am. And so if I say that I'm not going to drink and then I do, I'm going to have another log of failure on the fire that was just already consuming me, right? And so I literally felt stuck. I felt like my feet were in cement blocks and I was unwilling to give up booze, unwilling until I hit that rock bottom, because I thought, that's my treat. It is the one and only thing I have. And this is at the point, again, it was at the end, right, where it really wasn't working for me. And I knew that. I was constantly chasing a buzz that I could never keep. I could achieve it for, you know, 20 minutes. And then it was like, I need another drink. I mean, I was to the point I had to look up the liquor laws in different states so that if I was traveling with my kids, it's like, okay, when I land, how am I going to get booze? I was doing all that stuff, which presents as unmanageability in my life, right? Like that basically was like, yeah, this is a sign that if you're desperate enough to, you know, be looking up the liquor laws and be constantly like, where's my next drink coming from? How am I going to feel that sense of ease and comfort again? Mm-hmm. You know, I just look back on it now and I'm like, I can't believe I was so captive to alcohol the way that I was, but oh, it is fresh in my mind. Like I can also recall that feeling and I just, wow, I don't want that back ever again. And I think that, you know, it's amazing. Once I started acting my way into new thinking, so it's not like magically, you know, I went to treatment the second time and I was like, yay, I'm willing. This is great. I'm going to quit drinking. No, it was horrible, right? Like the first few weeks were like, all I could think about was drinking. I had that real obsession with alcohol and really had to get to the point where I was praying to a God that I didn't really even know whether it existed or not, but just to release me from that bondage so I could at least hear what was kind of being said or and what I was reading through the different books and the different podcasts and blogs that I was taking in at the time. I shouldn't say podcasts. It was more at that time, it was like tapes, but anyway, but it was huge. Once I sort of had that clarity shift of like, you know, maybe this alcohol, maybe this drinking was a really big part of the problem. Once I kind of that air sort of cleared, and I could kind of breathe a little bit, that allowed for like this open expansion of like, well, shoot, I mean, maybe anything's possible. Maybe actually a life without booze is not impossible. And maybe it could actually be kind of fulfilling. I mean, and that's when it started to turn a corner for me, was I continued on the path that I was going on, which again, for me was 12-step, and I got a sponsor and did all that. But also allowing myself to be open to new, instead of religious activities, spiritual activities. I had a counselor who was a shaman, for example. And the things that he would encourage me to do were very different than things I had ever done in the church. They were ritualistic things that I had not done before. Very powerful, tangible exercises on letting go of the things that no longer served me. And all of that was really a process of saying, you know what? I don't know. Whatever I've been doing to cover all this up hasn't worked, whether it was booze or pretending I was smart or understood concepts when I didn't, or not being willing to raise my hand and say, I have no idea what you're talking about, you know? And now, I mean, I got like so much to lose that I'm like, okay, wait, back it up. Hold on. What? I didn't understand that. Or I have no problem saying in most settings, yeah, I'm just kind of uncomfortable today for whatever reason. And I have tools to work with that feeling. And so I'm going to sit with that and I'm going to kind of investigate it. I'm going to figure out what's happening and I'm going to accept it, you know? And just know that that's what it is to be a female and to be a human, is to experience life and the ups and downs of it. But, you know, I definitely had that vacancy of soul that really needed a really good examining and pulling out some of those threads of like, no, it's okay not to be okay. I didn't think that was all right before. I thought it should all be pretty polished. So only when I said, yeah, no, you have permission to not be okay. That's when it started to get better for me. It's kind of paradoxical, but that's how it worked for me.
Yeah, no, I totally get everything you're saying. It really resonates. So now that you have this, you know, new, like multiple tools, new awareness around ADHD and just sensitivities and all these things, I'm sure it's reflected in your parenting and looking forward. You've written all these books, and one of the latest ones is a children's book. And I know that it's, you know, debuted very top of the list. Congratulations. It's very exciting. And I'd love for you to just tell us, you know, what inspired you to write that? Were your children actually asking for it? And you know, what is sort of your mission with a children's book specifically?
Sure. Yeah, thanks for that. So a handful of years ago, I was at Disney World and I was there with my kids, and I was sober by this point in time. And I actually have now 4 additional kids. So we had 4 more babies, which is 8 total. And so we are,
like I said, an expert in motherhood.
Well, that's so kind. I don't know. I'm pretty much convinced one of these days they're going to wake up and realize she doesn't know what she's doing. Like, she has no idea. But I do actually kind of tell them that. And I think they're kind of overly like, okay, yeah, we know you're figuring this out as you go. It's fine, whatever. But I was at Disney World. And so we were going in to watch this movie. And we got up at the end of it and they turn on the lights. And there was a woman, a row in front of us to the side. And she was passed out. And she had a toddler and I think a baby with her in an infant seat, from memory. I can't remember the details, but the point was, we could see track marks on her arm. We're that close where you could see that. And I just thought to myself, like, that's rough. And it's Disney World, right? So immediately people flocked over to her and like kind of tried to cover the scene and get the rest of us out of the theater really quick because nothing bad happens at Disney World, you know?
Right.
And I just remember thinking like, oh, wow. And those little kids were probably too little to have a big memory of whatever was going to happen after that or whatever happened before. But I don't know. I'm not a child psychologist, but it stirred and sparked in my heart like, gosh, you know, what did my kids go through? My older four, who were, my oldest was like 9 when I got pulled over for my DUI. And so I started asking them, you know, gosh, what do you remember from that time? What are some things that you saw? And primarily I wrote those children's books because, you know, as a mom, especially if we go off to treatment or we get help at whatever level that we get help, it's like, there's something in us that wants to just press pause, right? And go get better and then come back. And just be like, I'm back and I'm whole and yay. And it's not, it wasn't like that for me at least. Right? Like it's a process and I had to recover out loud. And they saw me struggle and they saw me do step work and they saw me like, you know, do crazy things. Like if I was triggered or tempted, you know, I'd be in the bathroom on my cell phone calling my sponsor and, you know, leaving them with a babysitter so I could go to an, you know, a 12-step meeting, like doing things that probably not a lot of their friends' moms were doing. And that's okay. You know, I had a blow and go in my car. So I'd pick them up from school. And if I was ever taking another kid with me, you know, they'd be like, what's that? You know, and it was like just mortifying, right? Like, oh my gosh, I can't believe these kids are watching me blow into this thing. But you know, it's so important. I know for me growing up, like I didn't see my parents as people at all, like going through their own stressors and their own healing processes of anything. I just saw them as like, they were just my mom and dad and, you know, they were the authority or whatever. And so now, especially that my older four are so much older and we have such open relationships, you know, it's like, I wouldn't trade recovering out loud for the world. Now, it wasn't always easy, right? There were some things that I had to let my older kids go through that, you know, they just had to go through. And I had to just be there to walk alongside them and help hold that lantern, knowing that I couldn't fix it for them, that I would actually do them a disservice by fixing, you know, and as moms, of course, we want to fix, we want to rush in and make it all better. And sharing with them like, oh my gosh, I've had those same feelings, or I've had experiences where I reacted this way and here's what was going on for me. And also throwing in the like old person caveat, like, yeah, I know I sound super old, but this happened to me and blah, blah, blah. But I think through showing that messy, not pretty side of things that I feel or apologizing, I mean, shoot, my parents like never apologized to me. I shouldn't say never, rarely. You know, it just wasn't a thing. It was a different generation. Yeah. And so, you know, I will have to go to my kids sometimes and just go, hey, I want to let you know that the reason I reacted that way, and I'm not saying it was okay, but I did it out of fear. And, you know, I was afraid that you might, you know, not talk to me anymore, or you might hide this from me or whatever. Like I've had to unpack my own self and my own issues for them to explain to them, like, this is mine and that's yours. And it's tough as a mom to navigate those waters because you know, sometimes we just want to say, no, this isn't, don't do that. It's too dangerous or whatever. And in that space of navigating that and just saying, like, this is my stuff and I'm scared, saying that to my kids has been one of the most empowering things that I've ever been able to do, because it creates a space where everybody's defenses are down and, you know, they are more receptive to, like, oh, okay, yeah, no, I totally get that. Like, I get being afraid just like they get being afraid. And so creating a safe space for everybody to just kind of be who they're going to be, process what we need to process, I think has been one of the greatest gifts of my life. And I don't think that I could have done that just by going along my merry way and trying to patch things up as best as possible and cover and put, you know, a costume on something, you know, that was really tearing me up inside. I feel like that did not do me a service that I wanted to continue in my life. And so it is so strange to look back on it now and just go, yeah, the way to gain what I have today was by way of going through all of that crap, you know, and I would do it again. You know, I would go through all of that stuff again in a heartbeat. But I also, you know, have friends who got sober and then sort of, you know, they don't do the work anymore, which is fine in their choice. But they also, you know, they don't have quite the same relationship with their kids as I have. And so I don't know. I feel like I'm rambling now. Sorry, I'm talking so much.
Yeah, well, I can definitely, I mean, I think something that's really like most people can relate to is that we, our generation at least, grew up in this environment that it wasn't really welcome to have a lot of overwhelming emotions expressed in our household. Right. So very early on, we learned to, like, there's certain emotions and certain ways that those certain emotions can be expressed, and otherwise, like, don't burden me or anyone else with your discomfort or your big feelings. And I think, you know, you and I are probably parenting quite differently than how we were parented, right? I mean, naturally, but particularly because we have this experience being like, that was part of the problem, that there wasn't some space and some recognition. It's okay to feel frustrated. Totally natural that you're devastated about that. Let me just sit here and be sad with you instead of, like, I'm uncomfortable, you're crying, can you, like, calm down already?
Right.
That kind of energy just is stifling. And I think we're both very passionate about, like, you know, our children, of course, but the next whole generation having some more, yes, tools and freedom to express themselves and not get, you know, found, I mean, what's the word I'm trying to say? Like, caught in these traps of looking for things to sort of self-soothe.
Yes.
And finding, like, unhealthy ways of dealing with totally normal emotions that we all have. You know, we all have bad days, mm-hmm, and we should all be saying sorry once in a while. Maybe not, you know, some people, maybe they're over apologizing, very people pleaser, but I think I completely resonate because I've had very positive reactions from, you know, I'm modeling to my kids that it's okay to screw up. You apologize, you take responsibility for, like you said, what was mine. Mm-hmm. Also point out, you know, there was this thing that, you know, might have been part of you, but it's still not acceptable how I reacted, and just owning it and holding space for people to have big emotions. So tell us more about, like, the specifics. So is it a series of books or it's a book?
It's 5 books. Okay. And what it is like the first one, Mommy Goes to Meetings. It's a child's perspective on watching their mom over drink and then go off to treatment and come back and rebuild a sober life. And so it's just a child's observations. So in no way am I any kind of an expert on any of the psychological or, you know, I am not a therapist, but I do know, based on talking to my kids, what they saw and the difference, you know, the stark difference between before and after. And then that middle period of the beginning of convalescing, right? And so then there's a brother, or daddy gets a diagnosis. That's the second one. And it talks about a father who loses his job and becomes depressed. And so again, it's that child's perspective of being in fear, seeing their dad go through this total lack of being able to get out of bed and address life again, and what that's like for the child. And I think a lot of times, you know, when we go through things, we forget that, like, oh, our kid is seeing us, and not that we have to protect them from it, but, you know, that they are learning and they're seeing these things. And that really the crucial, like the weaving thread throughout all five of the books, one is about a cousin going to counseling for the first time, and other mental disorders, and having the opportunity to go and get help for those things. The thread is getting help. So that's the element that is present in all five of the books. Yeah, is that eventually that person gets help. And there's one about an eating disorder, the sister who seeks a spiritual life. And so there, what that's like for the child, seeing, you know, a sister who goes through a terrible breakup and then stops eating, and what that's like. And then she ends up finding a spiritual practice and begins to get healthy and prioritize herself. And so just, I think the big message for me is to normalize getting help, right? That is, we're never going to avoid these challenges that, you know, come with life. Life is so lifey, right? And we have things that happen and things that occur, but really it's like choosing to value ourselves even when we don't really feel it yet, but to make ourselves aware that, like, yeah, we need to get help. I need to take care of myself so that I can take care of my kids, right? Like, I need to make sure that I have done that part and that work. So really that's what the books are there for, is to show kids it's normal to experience things and it's normal to get help.
Oh my goodness, I love that so much. And I think it's so important that you're providing, you know, not just parents, it sounds like there's lots of, you know, potential family members that would be included in this series, just giving families some tools, just some talking points, you know, like to sort of soften the way that we're talking about these things. And we all, you know, learn best through story, especially children. So that's amazing. I'm so happy that you did that. And I'm not surprised that it's doing so well. So what else? Where do you direct people if they want to contact you either personally or want to get a hand of the books?
Sure. So my books are all on Amazon. I'm at amylizharrison.com. That's my website. And across all the social media platforms, I'm at Amy Liz Harrison, just one word. So, you know,
You're still doing your podcast?
Yes, still doing the podcast. Yes, which I love. I get to learn from other people. I loved having you on my podcast, Megan. And I want to say, I just want to thank you. Just take a second to thank you for the work that you are doing. It's just so powerful and so important, you know, that women know that they can seek and find wellness, and, you know, it's various forms. And so I've been really impressed with the things that you're doing. So thank you for that.
Oh, thank you, Amy. That's so sweet of you. Your podcast, I've been on it, so I should know. I feel like it's Eternally Amy.
Oh, yes, you're right. Eternally Amy. Sorry. Yes, that's what it is. Yep.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much. We'll include all of that information in the show notes. I just appreciate you and your transparency, the way that you share your story with the world, I think is so valuable. And I know that you're helping so many people. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
We'll be in touch.
Okay, sounds great.
Hey there. One last thing I wanted to share with you. If you're enjoying this podcast, it would mean so much to me if you could rate and review it on your favorite podcast platform. It really does help us grow the show, and this being so important to me to get this message out to more women to help them optimize their wellness and ultimately their lives. This is my mission, and I would greatly appreciate it if you could support the podcast by rating and reviewing. Thanks in advance. Have a good one.